patron's excellent wines, no one who was present would have denied that he had earned it. No account has been found of Lewis's first meeting with Jefferson since his departure in July 1803, 3.5 years past. It can be taken for granted that Lewis had many questions about the political situation in the capital, but one can suppose that Jefferson overwhelmed Lewis with his curiosity about the natural wonders Lewis had encountered, the adventures he had experienced, the Indians he had seen, and the tales he had to tell, of grizzlies and gigantic trees and great storms, and the almost paradisiacal quality of the Great Plains and the deserts of the Upper Missouri, the fierceness of the Indians of the plains and the numbers of Indians on the Lower Columbia, the astonishing bird and animal life, and so much more. The words must have tumbled out. It is a great pity that Jefferson did not think to have a note-taker present, or to write his own summary of what was said. It must have been a joyous reunion, each man delighted to see the other in good health and spirits. The conversation would have had its downside, especially the disappointment over the Northwest Passage, but we can assume that Jefferson took the blow without flinching. British explorer Captain George Vancouver had caught the spirit of the era when he exclaimed that the ardor of the present age is to discover and delineate the true geography of the earth. Jefferson completely agreed. "So that's how it is," he might have said, and told Lewis to go on. Lewis would have had plenty to say about the promise of Louisiana and his plan for an American fur trade empire. Jefferson must have been delighted. As James Rhonda points out, generations of empire builders had used the fur trade to secure Indian allies, forestall potential imperial rivals, and expand territorial domain. The course of empire hung on the trade, and Jefferson knew it. Lewis had the journals with him, and Clark's map covering the western two-thirds of the continent. Surely they discussed publication. As Donald Jackson reminds us, literally, the world had been waiting for their return. And as James Rhonda points out, the Enlightenment taught that observation unrecorded was knowledge lost. Jefferson must have been delighted by samples of Lewis's descriptions of new flora and fauna, of landforms and soil conditions. Many years earlier, he had explained to a would-be explorer that science required very exact descriptions of what they see. On that point, Lewis had carried out Jefferson's orders exactly. Indeed, on almost every point, Lewis had accomplished his mission. How long the debriefing by the commander-in-chief lasted, what subjects came up, what was said, is all conjecture. One fact we do know: they spread the map on the floor, got down on hands and knees, and examined it. Chapter 32. Washington. January to March 1807. On January 2nd, the House created a committee to inquire what compensation ought to be made to Messrs. Lewis and Clark and their brave companions. Willis Alston, Jr. of North Carolina was named chairman. Lewis, who was living at the president's house, went to work on the politicians, for himself and for Clark and the men. Official Washington, meanwhile, wanted to honor the captains in a more immediate way, with a grand testimonial dinner and ball that would allow the politicians to be seen with and talk to the young heroes. Clark, however, was still in Virginia, courting Julia Hancock. Lewis was doing some courting of his own in Washington, although no details about this are known. The ball was put off on several occasions. Finally, it was decided to wait no more, and a date was set for January 14th. Indicative of the excitement in the capital was a recommendation from Joel Barlow, considered by himself and some others to be the leading poet of the nation, to rename the Great River of the West, changing it from Columbia to Lewis. Pierre Chouteau and Big White accompanied Lewis to the ball. Jefferson was not listed in the newspaper account of the dinner, so it can be assumed he was not among the several officers of government who attended. Dumas Malone explains that Jefferson abominated such occasions, and he may have believed that his presence would distract attention from the returned hero. Many toasts were drunk, to the Constitution, to Lewis and Clark, and so on. Barlow offered one, "To victory over the wilderness, which is more interesting than that over man." Lewis offered his own, "May works be the test of patriotism, as they ought of right to be of religion. After the toast, the party sat down to what the National Intelligencer described as a well-spread board. Barlow wrote a poem of 8 stanzas, full of bombast, bad rhymes, and mixed metaphors, that was read after dinner. An example. Then hear the loud voice of the nation proclaim, and all the ages resound the decree, let our Occident stream bear the young hero's name who taught him his path to the sea. This was too much for Senator John Quincy Adams, who wrote a parody ridiculing Jefferson as a philosopher and a man absurdly credulous. Adams wrote about what Lewis did not find: mammoth or mammoth bones, Welsh Indians, Salt Mountain. As far as Adams was concerned, Lewis was extravagant in his storytelling. What marvels on the way he found, he'll tell you if inclined, sir. But what really set Adams off was Barlow's proposal to rename the Columbia. Let old Columbus be once more degraded from his glory, and not a river by his name remember him in story. For what is old discovery compared to that which new is? Strike, strike Columbia River out, and put in River Lewis. As to Barlow's line about Lewis teaching the Columbia its path to the sea, Adams wrote in a footnote, here the young hero is exhibited in the interesting character of schoolmaster to a river. Malone comments that this bit of doggerel revealed more wit than most observers would have expected of the sober senator from Massachusetts, and a more partisan spirit than his public actions showed. Jefferson, wisely, never followed up on Barlow's proposal. So Columbus, already defrauded of the name of a hemisphere, kept his river. Lewis stayed at the president's house through the winter. The debriefing continued. In mid-February, Jefferson wrote Secretary Dearborn that in conversation with Lewis, he had discussed the items that any future explorers of Louisiana ought to take with them. At the top of the list was blue beads, preferred by the Indians to all others. Lewis told Jefferson that if he were to perform his journey again, one half to two-thirds of his stores would consist of blue beads, brass buttons, knives, battle axes and tomahawks, but not rifles, awls, glover's needles, iron combs, nests of camp kettles, and arrow points. Lewis also worked on the accounts from the expedition and talked with the politicians about compensation, seeking more money and land for his men, and justice for Clark. In conversation with Secretary Dearborn, he insisted that whatever grant of land Congress might give him, Clark's should be the same. He further insisted, there should be no distinction of rank. Dearborn, who was the cause of this sorry mess about rank, refused. In responding to Congressman Alston's request for a formal recommendation from the War Department on compensation, Dearborn proposed that each of the men receive a warrant for 320 acres, the standard Revolutionary War veterans bonus, that Clark receive 1,000 acres, and Lewis 1,500. Lewis drew up his own formal recommendation, not for himself or Clark, but for the enlisted men. He began with a plea for 2 enlisted men who did not make the journey past Fort Mandan, Corporal Richard Worthington and Private John Newman. Lewis had discharged Newman from the party for mutinous expression at Fort Mandan, but he had conducted himself admirably since and had been invaluable to Worthington on the voyage back to St. Louis. Then Lewis listed all the men, except York, who had been to the Pacific and back. He asked for additional compensation for Private Labiche, on the grounds that Labiche had served as translator from French to English, in addition to his regular duties, for Private John Shields, whose ingenuity in repairing our guns was indispensable, for the Field Brothers, 2 of the most active and enterprising young men who accompanied us, and for George Druelyard, which was perhaps an improvement on his usual spelling of Dreuyer, whom Lewis described as a man of much merit. Driard's skills with the sign language and as a hunter and woodsman were performed with an ardor which deserves the highest commendation. He had signed Driard on at $25 a month, but recommended that he receive 30 per month. Lewis was negative only toward Charbonneau, a man of no peculiar merit. He had hired Charbonneau on as interpreter at $25 a month, but obviously thought it unjust that he receive the same pay as Drouillard. Lewis ended his recommendation with a plea for all the men whose conduct had entitled them to my warmest approbation and thanks, nor will I suppress the expression of a hope that the recollection of services thus faithfully performed will meet a just reward and an ample remuneration on the part of our government. On January 23rd, Alston presented his bill for compensation. It called for 1,600 acres each to Lewis and Clark, 320 acres to each of the enlisted men, and double pay for all. That included Worthington, Newman, Drouillard, and Charbonneau. There was no provision for anything extra for Labiche, Shields, or the Field Brothers, nor did Drouillard get the extra $5 per month. The appropriation to cover the compensation amounted to $11,000. The Alston bill was hotly debated in the House. Some representatives contended that the grants were extravagant and beyond precedent. One member declared, "It was the equivalent to taking more than $60,000 out of the Treasury, and might be perhaps 3 or 4 times that sum, as the grantees might go over all the western country and locate their warrants on the best land, worth far more than the standard $2 per acre." It took the House over a month to pass the bill, by a vote of 62-23. On the same day they did so, February 28th, the bill passed the Senate without amendment and with little debate, and without a recorded vote. Perhaps luckily for Senator Adams, whose doggerel attacking Lewis and Jefferson was later used against him politically. The pay scale ranged from $5 per month for privates, $7 for corporals, and $8 for sergeants, to $30 for Lieutenant Clark, and $40 for Captain Lewis. The officers also received reimbursements for rations for themselves, and in Clark's case, for York. For Lewis, that meant a total of $3,360 in pay for the period April 1, 1803 to October 1807, plus $702 in ration money, plus land warrants worth $3,200 payable at any government land office, or a grand total of $7,262. That hardly made him rich, but it did give him some working capital for the expenses involved in preparing the journals for publication, with enough left over to let him become a player in the St. Louis-based fur trade. For himself, for Clark, except for his pay scale, for the men, it was all Lewis could have hoped for or expected. There were more expenses to be paid, including the cost of getting Big White back to the Mandans. Obviously, when the final settlement was made, the expedition was going to turn out costing a lot more than had been anticipated. Jefferson never complained. He was no more likely to haggle over the costs of the expedition than over his own building operations at Monticello, because he regarded the expenditure as an investment in the future of the country. In July 1808, the president went on record on the matter. He wrote the French naturalist Bernard Lacépède, "I can assure you that the addition to our knowledge in every department resulting from this tour of Messrs. Lewis and Clark has entirely fulfilled my expectations in setting it on foot, and that the world will find that those travelers have well earned its favor." There was another compensation for the captains in the form of their new appointments. On February 28, 1807, Jefferson nominated Lewis to be governor of the territory of Louisiana. The Senate approved the nomination, and on March 2nd, Lewis resigned his commission in the Army. At the same time, Jefferson wanted to nominate Clark for promotion to lieutenant colonel, but when the list of nominees came through from the War Department, Clark's name was not on it. The president queried his Secretary of War, who explained that Clark had been left off through a misunderstanding of my directions by a clerk. The Senate rejected Clark's nomination, but as Clark explained to his brother in a March 5th letter, it was done on the grounds of breaking through a principle, namely seniority. Clark said he was truly gratified nevertheless, for the senators had all told him they would confirm any other nomination, and indeed did so when Jefferson appointed him Superintendent of Indian Affairs for Louisiana Territory, with the rank of Brigadier General of Militia. It was midwinter in Washington, wet and cold. At the president's house, Jefferson's son-in-law, Thomas Mann Randolph, took ill. His fever rose and fell, leaving Jefferson alternately worried and hopeful. The doctor was bleeding the invalid, which certainly did him no good. Jefferson wrote his daughter Martha progress reports, complaining on one occasion that the quantity of blood taken from him occasions him to recover strength slowly. On March 6th, Jefferson informed Martha that Captain Lewis was constantly with Randolph, attending to his needs. Whatever Randolph had, Lewis caught. Jefferson also had a bad cold. Between them, Jefferson wrote Martha, "We are but a collection of invalids." Clark, meanwhile, had made it to Washington, where he was gathering up the land warrants for the men still in St. Louis, and the money due them, and preparing to head west to his new post. He and Lewis had agreed that Lewis would stay behind in the East to oversee the publication of their journals in Philadelphia. Clark's first task in St. Louis would be to see to Big White's safe return. To that end, Dearborn gave him a letter authorizing him to spend up to $400 for presents to the Mandans and to draw on the War Department for expenditures that were indispensably necessary in fitting out the party for the voyage. As an inducement to get an armed party of private traders to join Sergeant Nathaniel Pryor, recently promoted to ensign, who would lead the party returning Big White, Dearborn further authorized Clark to enter into contracts with any St. Louis merchants who were interested in pursuing the Missouri River fur trade, granting them a 2-year monopoly on a license to trade with the Indians and furnishing their engagés with rifles and ammunition. Clark received this authorization on March 9th. The following day, he visited Lewis in the president's house and was distressed to see his friend so indisposed by his illness. Lewis roused himself sufficiently to go over the details of the land warrants and the back pay. He handed over the warrants plus $6,896 in coin. They discussed the return of Big White and agreed that Pryor should attempt to enlist any men from the expedition still in St. Louis who were willing to go. After Clark left, Lewis took some pills, whether Rush's or some others is not known. The next morning, he wrote his friend, already en route to St. Louis, that the pills had provided considerable relief, and I have no doubt of recovering my health perfectly in the course of a few days. He must have, because 3 days later he sent an open letter to the National Intelligencer condemning several unauthorized and probably some spurious publications now preparing for the press on the subject of my late tour to the Pacific Ocean by individuals entirely unknown to me, and warning the public to be on guard with respect to such publications. He said these spurious works would depreciate the worth of the work he was preparing, and asked for patience from the public, which was clamoring for the journals. As much time, labor, and expense are absolutely necessary in order to do justice to the several subjects. With the letter, he included an announcement of his own work, which would give interested people an opportunity to join the list of subscribers. He promised to have the map published by the end of October, with the first volume, The Narrative, following by January 1, 1808, the second, On the Geography of the Country, the Indians Encountered, and the Prospects for the Fur Trade, and the third, On Scientific Discoveries, coming shortly thereafter. Lewis said that only Robert Fraser had been given permission to publish his journal, and warned that Fraser, who was only a private, was entirely unacquainted with any scientific matters and could provide merely a limited detail of our daily transactions. He concluded, "With respect to all unauthorized publications relative to this voyage, I presume that they cannot have stronger pretensions to accuracy of information than that of Robert Fraser." It was a strange document, mean-spirited in tone and content, so unlike Lewis, who had previously been active in promoting the interests of Clark and the men. It was defensive, even greedy. There were no misspellings, which indicates that someone proofread it for him. It used words Lewis did not ordinarily use, such as depreciate, subjoined, and expunged. Further, Lewis was a man whose reputation for telling the truth was unassailable, but he almost certainly lied when he wrote that he had heard reports to the effect that individuals entirely unknown to him were preparing books on the expedition. What he had heard was that Sergeant Gass was about to issue a prospectus for a book based on the daily journal he had kept, as Captain Lewis had ordered him to do. In fact, the Gass prospectus did appear 6 days later in the Pittsburgh Gazette. All this leads to the conjecture that, when Jefferson and Lewis heard about the Gass journal, they went into something akin to a panic. Jefferson may have urged Lewis to issue his warning against spurious publications and helped him write the letter. Whoever was responsible for the letter, it was a mistake. It made Lewis look cheap, ungrateful, pleading for special interests, himself. It opened him to ridicule. He could be considered guilty of a double cross, for he had given Fraser permission to publish and then denigrated the product, which he had not seen. And how dare he assert his right to publish for profit while denying it to Fraser and Gass? The battle in Washington over who got the insider's memoirs out first was underway, a battle Lewis was sure to lose. It would cheapen his product, which infuriated him. It would cut into his profit, which made him so angry he lost his common sense. Lewis knew how vulnerable he was on the money question. In his prospectus, he wrote that the author declares to the public that his late voyage was not undertaken with a view to pecuniary advantages, and explained that he was asking for subscribers only because he needed to know how many copies to print. If Jefferson was party to this sordid stuff, as seems likely, he too was guilty of gross misjudgment. The Gass prospectus was as bad, from Lewis's point of view, as it could have been. It promised a daily narrative, a description of the country and its flora and fauna, soil and minerals, and more. What really hurt was a paragraph explaining that around the campfire, the several journals were brought together, compared, corrected, and the blanks filled up, meaning that early subscribers would be reading material corrected and approved by the captains. What cut to the bone was the publisher's promise to have the work ready for delivery in 2 months for a price of $1 per copy. There went Lewis's market. To add to the injury, Gass's publisher sent to the newspapers his reply to Lewis's warning to the public. The publisher seized on the vulnerabilities Lewis had created to ridicule him. He wrote of what you very modestly call your late tour. He said Mackenzie had faced greater dangers with one-fourth of the men and done it first. He attacked Lewis's compensation from the government. Why, sir, these grants and rewards savor more of the splendid munificence of a prince than the economy of a republican government. He raised the question, where was your journal during the session of Congress? Snug, eh? He exposed Lewis's double standard. Every man of sense must agree that these journals are either private property of the individuals who took them or public property. In one sentence, he managed to show he knew what he was talking about while suggesting that Gass's journal would be more readable than Lewis's. He may, in some respects, be considered as having the advantage, for while Your Excellency was stargazing and taking celestial observations, he was taking observations in the world below. Lewis's work had been insulted and preempted. He was a writer. We can assume that his mind never stopped composing his reply. But he had the good sense, finally, to keep quiet. He made no public response. One of the would-be authors, Robert Fraser, was in Washington. He was planning to join Clark in Fincastle, Virginia, for a return trip to St. Louis, where he had been called to appear in the trial of some of the Burr conspirators. Despite Lewis's comments about Fraser in the newspapers, the two men maintained a friendly relationship. Lewis loaned him $50 with the understanding that Clark would deduct that amount from Fraser's compensation and return it to Lewis. He sent via Fraser Clark's commission as Brigadier General of Militia and instructions for Frederick Bates, appointed by Jefferson to be Secretary of the Territory, a position equivalent to that of Lieutenant Governor. Clark was staying at the home of Colonel George Hancock, Julia's father. In a mid-March letter to Lewis, he reported that he had sent Fraser on to St. Louis, along with Lewis's letter to Bates and one of his own. Clark was in a fine mood. He had his commission, he was headed west, his friend was arranging for the publication of his map and journal, and he had been successful in his courtship. In reporting on the latter, he wrote with uncommon levity. "I have made and attacked most vigorously," he began. "We have come to terms, and a delivery is to be made 1st of January, when I shall be in possession highly pleasing to myself. I shall return to Virginia at that time, eagerly to be in possession of what I have never yet experienced." He hoped Governor Lewis would not object to his absence from St. Louis. You can hint a little on that subject if you think proper and let me know. Like most young men in love, Clark wanted a similar happiness for his friend. He made an oblique reference to F, a young woman Lewis was courting. "But should the thing not take to your wish," he went on, "I have discovered a most lovely girl, beautiful, rich, possessing those accomplishments which is calculated to make a man happy, inferior to you, but to few others." The only trouble was her father was a Federalist. But that handicap could be overlooked, Clark said, and he knew because he had done it. He confessed he was surprised to discover that Colonel Hancock is also a Fed. I took him to be a good plain Republican. At all events, I will hope to introduce some substantial, sincere Republicanism into some branch of the family about January. The head of the Republican Party was also in a good mood. Jefferson was doing what he liked to do best, distributing new knowledge to his naturalist friends. On March 22nd, he sent Bernard McMahon some seeds brought back by Lewis, explaining that he would not get to Monticello in time to plant them and thought McMahon might put them in the ground in Philadelphia. Jefferson added that Lewis had some seeds set aside for McMahon and would be handing them over when he arrived in Philadelphia, and advised McMahon to say nothing of your receiving the enclosed seeds, lest it might lessen the portion he will be disposed to give you. In his letter of thanks, McMahon said, "I never saw seeds in a better state of preservation." High praise for Lewis's methods. A couple of weeks later, he reported that he already had a fine showing from the Arica tobacco, the perennial flax, four varieties of currants, and other seeds. He promised regular reports on the progress of this precious collection. 2 days later, Jefferson sent seeds to another Philadelphia naturalist, William Hamilton, with a similar covering note. In it, Jefferson summed up the results of the 3 months Lewis had spent in the president's house, 3 months of almost daily debriefings on what Lewis had done and found. It was a splendid tribute to his young protégé. "On the whole," the president wrote of Lewis, "the result confirms me in my first opinion that he was the fittest person in the world for such an expedition." Chapter 33. Philadelphia, April to July 1807. At the end of March, Lewis left Washington for Philadelphia, taking with him what Paul Russell Cutright has called perhaps the most important account of discovery and exploration ever written. His objective was singular: to get the journals and map published and made available to the scientific and lay public as soon as possible. He went at it with as much determination as he had attacked the Rocky Mountains. He got a room at the boarding house of Mrs. Eliza Wood, at Cherry, near 10th, and began making calls on the dozen or more men he was relying on for help. He started with John Conrad, head of a publishing and bookselling firm located at 30 Chestnut Street. As a first-time author, Lewis knew nothing about the preparation of a manuscript for the printer. There were plates to be prepared for the maps, drawings to be done, calculations from the celestial observations to be made, botanical descriptions to be completed, a prospectus to be written, published, and distributed, and more. Most important of all was the editing of the journals. Conrad's estimate of the publishing costs came to $4,500. This did not include the drawings, calculations, salary for an editor, who presumably would be going to St. Louis with Lewis, and other expenses, all of which would come from Lewis's pocket. Conrad also wrote, or at least helped Lewis write, a formal prospectus, which was signed by Lewis and published on June 3, 1807. Lewis had to pay for the marketing. He hired J.B. Varnum, Jr., son of a prominent Massachusetts politician, to do the work at a cost of $10. Varnum sent copies to the newspapers and distributed copies in Philadelphia, Washington, and elsewhere. The prospectus was well done, nicely designed to excite the greatest interest around the country among entrepreneurs looking to invest in the fur trade, potential settlers in the West, scientists, and the general public. Lewis promised that the first part, consisting of 2 volumes, would contain a narrative of the voyage. The second part, in a single volume, would cover the scientific research, under the heads of botany, mineralogy, and zoology. Part 3 would consist of Clark's map, along with the latitude and longitude of the important places, based on a series of several hundred celestial observations made by Captain Lewis during his tour. The price would be $10 for the first part, $11 for the second, and $10 for the map. That was a lot to promise. Lewis plunged into the task of making good on his word. He called on Dr. Barton at his home at 184 Mulberry Street, depending on Barton for help with a natural history volume. Barton agreed eagerly. There was so much to excite him in the collection of pressed plants. Lewis had done the pressing in the field, following directions given him by Barton in the spring of 1803, and had done the demanding, time-consuming, detailed work well. Almost all the plants were new to science, as were most of the animals. Lewis returned to Barton the copy of Antoine Duprat's History of Louisiana that Barton had loaned him on the eve of his departure. On the flyleaf, Lewis wrote, "Dr. Benjamin Smith Barton was so obliging as to lend me this copy of Monsieur Duprat's History of Louisiana in June 1803. It has since been conveyed by me to the Pacific Ocean through the interior of North America on my late tour thither, and is now returned to its proprietor by his friend and obedient servant, Meriwether Lewis, Philadelphia, May 9, 1807. The inscribed book is today in the Library Company, Philadelphia, a piece of Americana beyond price. The book, along with the others in Lewis's traveling library, was one of the few artifacts to go coast to coast and back with Lewis. Aside from the books and the then blank journals, almost everything else he took with him from Philadelphia in 1803, medicines, portable soup, scientific instruments, trade goods, and the rest, was either used up on the voyage or sold at auction in St. Louis when he returned. About the only other item Lewis carried from Pittsburgh to the Pacific and back was his rifle. Books, the journals, and a rifle. These were Meriwether Lewis's essentials. With them, he had conquered and described a wilderness. Frederick Pirsch was a 33-year-old, German-born and trained botanist working with Dr. Barton. On April 5th, Jefferson's friend and Philadelphia seed merchant Bernard McMahon wrote to Lewis to thank him for the seeds and to recommend Pirsch to him as the proper person to make the scientific descriptions of the plants. McMahon said Pirsch was better acquainted with plants in general than any man I ever conversed with on the subject. He is a very intelligent and practical botanist and would be well inclined to render you any service in his power. When Lewis met Pirsch, he was as impressed as McMahon had been, especially by Pirsch's ability to draw plants and to give them proper scientific descriptions, areas in which Lewis felt himself to be deficient. Pirsch was excited by the prospect of assisting in the publication of the botanical part of the journals, as well he might have been, since there were over 100 plants described by Pirsch as either entirely new or but little known. On May 10th, Lewis paid Pirsch $30 for assisting me in preparing drawings and arranging specimens of plants for my work, and 2 weeks later he paid Pirsch an additional $40 in advance. Jefferson and Lewis were of one mind in regarding Peale's Museum in Independence Hall as the most logical repository for the zoological and ethnological specimens brought back from the West. As a result, with the exception of a few retained by Jefferson for the Great Hall at Monticello, and two or three fancied by Lewis and Clark themselves, Lewis handed the collection over to Peale, which enhanced the prestige of his museum immeasurably. In return, Peale went to work drawing the animals, which he mounted himself, for Lewis's book. He also painted Lewis's portrait. It is today in the Independence National Historical Park, Philadelphia, hanging in the distinguished company of Peale's portraits of Washington and Jefferson. And he made a wax figure of Lewis, informing Jefferson that his intention was to give a lesson to the Indians who may visit the museum, and also to show my sentiments respecting wars. He had Lewis dressed in an elegant Indian robe made of 140 ermine skins, given to Lewis by Cameawait. Peale was tremendously excited by the specimens. "I have animals brought from the seacoast," he exulted to Philadelphia musician John Hawkins in a May 5th letter. "Also some parts of the dress, etc., of the natives of Columbia River, and have animals totally unknown." In 1807, Lewis attended three meetings of the American Philosophical Society, April 17th, June 19th, and July 17th, where it can be assumed he was the center of attention, bombarded with questions from the leading scientific figures of the day. Most of all, they wanted to know publication plans. "It is a work that seems to excite much attention," Peale told Hawkins, "and will, I hope, have a great sale and give considerable profit to this bold adventurer." To help ensure that hoped-for success, Lewis got other artists involved. John James Bartlett was a 60-year-old Irish-born engraver. On July 14th, Lewis paid him $40 for two drawings of waterfalls. He engaged the well-known 37-year-old French-born portrait painter, Sam Memmott, to do drawings of the Osage and Mandan Indians who would come east with him at a cost of $83.50. Sam Memmott also painted Lewis's portrait. Alexander Wilson was a 31-year-old Scottish-born artist naturalist, best known today for his beautifully illustrated, multi-volumed American Ornithology. In that work, Wilson wrote, "It was the request and particular wish of Captain Lewis made to me in person that I make drawings of each of the feathered tribe as had been preserved and were new." Among others from the expedition, the set includes Wilson's painting of Lewis's woodpecker. Lewis had a journal stuffed with figures. The measurements of the passage of the moon past the stars, taken at every opportunity along the voyage. They had cost him much lost sleep and considerable frustration when clouds obscured the moon. But with the figures, an expert could establish the longitude of the place where they were made. Ferdinand Hassler, a 37-year-old Swiss-born mathematician, was the ideal man for the job. He had just been appointed instructor of mathematics at West Point, but before leaving Philadelphia, Lewis engaged him to make the calculations. He advanced Hassler $100 on May 3rd. Before Clark left for St. Louis in March 1807, the captains had made an oral agreement to split the costs involved in preparing the work. They had also agreed to purchase Sergeant Ordway's journal from him at a price of $300, presumably with the objective of forestalling yet another rival and to incorporate Ordway's writing into their book. On April 18th, Lewis paid Ordway a $150 advance. By July, Lewis had signed up botanists, ornithologists, naturalists, artists, mathematicians, zoologists, and others to help make his work as good as it could possibly be. He had done everything he could to hurry along the publication process, except one thing. He had not hired an editor. This is inexplicable. He knew Conrad could not simply set type from the journals as they stood. In the first place, there was the daunting task of separating out the scientific material from the narrative flow. Then there was the need to incorporate Ordway's journal. In addition, there was the pressing necessity of correcting the spellings and grammar. Lewis had neither the skills nor the time to do these jobs himself. He was being pressed on an almost daily basis by Conrad to start turning in manuscript. At the American Philosophical Society, and around Philadelphia, the question he most often heard was, "When do we get to see the book?" He knew that Jefferson greatly desired as early a publication as possible. He had sufficient funds to hire the work done. Yet, as far as is known, he made no effort whatsoever to find an editor, and he prepared not a single line himself. Lewis spent considerable time on paperwork. Scarcely had he arrived in Philadelphia when the accountant of the War Department, one William Simmons, began to pester him about the many drafts on the government Lewis had signed. The drafts were coming in for payment, and Simmons wanted more information about them. On June 17th, in one of his letters, Simmons wrote the heart-stopping lines, "You will therefore do well to bring with you, back to Washington, any papers or documents which may relate to your expenditures on the expedition, so as to explain such of the charges as may require it." As one example, Lewis had presented no receipts for the rations or the clothing account for the men. "I mention this item as the most prominent one, but others may also require proof." The total number of drafts involved ran to 1,989 items. Like any public servant who has his expense account questioned by the government, Lewis was going to find it somewhere between difficult and impossible to come up with all the receipts. Still, he worked at the task, both in Philadelphia and later back in Washington. By early August, he had a final summation ready. It came to $38,722.25. For many of the drafts, the government was simply going to have to take Lewis's word for it. One charming example went back to March 1806, when Lewis had traded his uniform coat, but little worn, to the Clatsops for a canoe. Of course, no receipt existed. Lewis listed it this way. One uniform laced coat, one silver epaulette, one dirk and belt, one hanger and belt, one pistol and one fowling piece, all private property given in exchange for canoe, horses, etc., for public service during the expedition, $135. It is easy to sympathize with Lewis over this bureaucratic harassment, but he really was playing fast and loose with the government during this time. Though living in Philadelphia, engaged in what was essentially a private enterprise, he was governor of Louisiana. Beyond writing one letter to Secretary Bates asking information about conditions in St. Louis, he had done absolutely nothing on his job. Yet on June 28th, he presented Secretary of State James Madison with a bill for his salary from March 3rd to June 30th, totaling $666.66. "You would much oblige me," he wrote Madison, "by forwarding a check on the Bank of the United States for the amount as early as it may be convenient." The State Department, which ran territorial affairs, deducted $5.55 as an overcharge and paid the remainder. Jefferson, meanwhile, was torn. He wanted Lewis to get the book out, but he was beginning to have cause to regret appointing him governor, for there was turmoil in St. Louis. More Americans arrived daily, creating squabbles over deeds of land, trading licenses, Indian rights, and the other usual items of contention on the frontier. A firm hand was needed. On June 4th, the president had written Lewis a chatty letter. "Your mother returned from Georgia in good health a little before I left Monticello," signing off with "friendly salutations and assurances of constant affection and respect." But in an August 8th letter, written from Monticello, the president expressed a certain anxiety as to when Lewis was going to go to St. Louis to take up his responsibilities. He wanted Lewis to get started on "the restoration of that harmony in the territory so essential to its happiness and so much desired by me," and indicated that he expected Lewis to be now proceeding to take up his post. In his June letter, the president had the painful task of informing Lewis that he had sent 25 boxes of artifacts brought back from the West via a ship from Washington to Richmond, but the ship had been stranded and everything was lost save some horns. Probably the moose and wapiti horns now hanging at Monticello. Lewis, in reply, said he sincerely regretted the loss and commented in what could be read as an implied criticism of Jefferson's lack of care of the priceless artifacts, "It seems peculiarly unfortunate that those, at least, which had passed the continent of America, and after their exposure to so many casualties and risks, should have met such destiny in their passage through a small portion only of the Chesapeake." Lewis was leading a very heady life. At 33, he was the most celebrated man in Philadelphia, a city world-renowned for its celebrated men. He was the protege of the president. Balls and testimonials were held in his honor, the biggest in the nation's capital. He had been generously rewarded by Congress, praised by the leading scientists of the day, appointed governor of the biggest territory of the United States, and was the center of attention wherever he went. His prospects could hardly have been better. It was perhaps too much success too early in life. There were, perhaps, too many balls with too many toasts. Public drunkenness was so commonplace in early 19th century America that it was seldom commented upon. Certainly no one would have objected to the young hero celebrating his triumph. Still, he was doing a lot of heavy drinking. On April 20th, he entered into his account book a payment of $5 to his landlady, Mrs. Wood, for a dozen of porter. On May 5th, it was $10 for a dozen of ale. More telling, he was out on the town almost every night. His companion was Malan Dickerson, whom he had first met in 1802. Dickerson, a 37-year-old lawyer and bachelor who moved in the highest social circles in Philadelphia, later served as governor of New Jersey, Senator from New Jersey, and Secretary of the Navy in President Andrew Jackson's second term. His diary records numerous evenings spent with Lewis in the spring and early summer of 1807. They dined out regularly and often went for walks around the center square, today's Penn Square, a popular park and parade ground. On July 2nd, Dickerson noted in his diary, "Rode out with Captain Lewis to the Marshalls. Spent the day very pleasantly in eating, drinking, and shooting at the trees." On the 4th of July, "Dined with a large party at Fouquet's, delivered a flaming speech to them, kept myself very sober, went to the play at evening, the house very uproarious." That same day, Lewis also attended a dinner party given by the Society of the Friends of the People at the Spring Garden Tavern. To the 160 guests, he proposed a political toast. "May the man who has by profession and act proved his sincere attachment for peace never quit our national helm at a crisis like this." The crisis was with the British, who had attacked and seized the U.S. frigate Chesapeake off the Virginia Capes on June 22nd. Jefferson's policy was to avoid war if at all possible, while imposing an embargo on Britain. On July 7th, Lewis and Dickerson walked till 11 at night. These walks were a regular thing with them. It seems likely that they frequented taverns as they moved along. On July 18th, Dickerson recorded that they went out together and saw a fight in which a knife was flashed and a man's face cut, which certainly sounds like a barroom brawl. Jefferson later wrote of the habit into which he, Lewis, had fallen, and the painful reflections that would necessarily produce in a mind like his. It seems that Lewis's high-mindedness caused him to curse himself every morning, and possibly to swear off drinking, only to go back to another ball or for another walk with Dickerson that night. Lewis had problems beyond coping with his celebrity status and his drinking. His friend Clark had found a wife. Lewis wanted one. That fall, he wrote Dickerson in a bantering tone, recalling some of his adventures with the girls during the summer. He said he was trying to think of those bewitching gypsies as a secondary consideration, but admitted that Miss E. Blank B. Blank Y. of Philadelphia will still remain provokingly important in spite of all my philosophy. Then he fired off a series of questions that had all the marks of coming from a man in love. "Have you heard from her? Have you seen her? How is she? Is she well, sick, dead, or married?" Whatever the answers, quite clearly he had failed in his courtship. He went on, "I am now a perfect widower with respect to love. I feel all that restlessness, that inquietude, that certain indescribable something common to old bachelors, which I cannot avoid thinking, my dear fellow, proceeds from that void in our hearts, which might or ought to be better filled. Whence it comes, I know not. But certain it is that I never felt less like a hero than at the present moment. What may be my next adventure, God knows, but on this I am determined, to get a wife." Meriwether Lewis was a man who usually got what he was determined to get. Chapter 34. Virginia. August 1806 to March 1807. Sometime in late July, Lewis journeyed to Washington, where he turned in his records and receipts to Mr. Simmons in the War Department. He then went to Locust Hill in Ivy to be with his family. He took the journals with him. In August, he visited Jefferson at Monticello. In September, he traveled to Richmond, where he was an observer of Burr's treason trial, perhaps at Jefferson's request, with the duty of writing a report. No Lewis report is known to exist, however, and Jefferson was scrupulous in saving his correspondence. Back in Ivy, Lewis saw to family business, primarily land speculation in the Ohio Valley. Before setting out for the Pacific in 1803, he had urged his mother to make certain his half-brother, John Marks, got an education. In 1807, he took charge of young Marks's professional training. He arranged for Marks to go to Philadelphia to attend medical lectures, with letters of introduction to the various savants in town. He told Marks to call on Dickerson frequently and ask Dickerson to look after him, for "we both know that young men are sometimes in want of a friend." Lewis gave Marks $60 and asked Dickerson to advance him $200, which he would repay when he received his salary, on January 15th, as governor for the last 3 months of the year. Some money was coming in from subscribers to the journals. A William Woods, perhaps a local Baptist minister, or perhaps the Woods who was a surveyor of Albemarle County, was his agent. Woods received the $31 total from a number of local residents. Other monies came in by mail. Lewis had written Clark about one of his courtships. Clark had replied with a recommendation for a Miss C. Lewis had replied in cryptic fashion, "For God's sake, do not whisper my attachment to Miss Blank, or I am undone." Who Miss C and Miss Blank were, or what happened, is unknown. Lewis and Clark biographer John Bakeless speculates that perhaps they didn't meet Lewis's standards. What mere girl could approach the grace, the charm, the intelligence, and the tremendous vigor of his fascinating mother? Perhaps the girls didn't want to get into a competition with Lucy Marks. Sometime later in Philadelphia, Lewis had what he described to Dickerson as a little affair with Miss A. Blank N. R. Blank S. H. The relationship, he reported, had neither beginning nor end on her part. Per contra, on my own, it has had both. The fact is that on inquiry I found that she was previously engaged, and therefore dismissed every idea of prosecuting my pretensions in that quarter. Then there was Lewis's intense interest in Miss E. Blank B. Blank Y., which also led nowhere. In late November, Lewis and his younger brother Reuben, who was planning to join the governor in St. Louis and get into the fur trade, went to Fincastle, where they stayed in the home of Clark's father-in-law, George Hancock. There, the brothers met Letitia and Elizabeth Breckinridge, daughters of General James Breckinridge. Reuben wrote to the family back home, "We had the pleasure of seeing the accomplished and beautiful Miss Letitia Breckinridge, one of the most beautiful women I have ever seen, both as to form and features. I should like to have her as a sister." Lewis was smitten at first sight. He expressed his intention of making a formal call on Letitia, but he evidently came on too strong. Miss Breckinridge heard of the governor's intention of courting her, and concluded that if she remained, it would look too much like a challenge. She accompanied her father on a trip to Richmond. Reuben reported that, "Unfortunately for His Excellency, Lewis, she left the neighborhood 2 days after our arrival, so that he was disappointed in his design of addressing her." Letitia's sister Elizabeth was still in Fincastle, but Lewis had been so taken with Letitia that he was diffident about approaching her. Sometime later, he wrote to a friend from his early army career, "I consider Miss Elizabeth Breckinridge a charming girl, but such was my passion for her sister that my soul revolts at the idea of attempting to make her my wife, and I shall not consequently travel that road in quest of matrimony." Whether he courted other young women in Ivy and Fincastle is unknown. Indeed, what he did, even where he lived for that winter of 1807-8, is unknown. For the most part, the 8 months between Lewis's departure from Philadelphia and his arrival in St. Louis were a lost period in his life. The only thing productive he did was begin work on a major paper recommending a basic Indian policy for Louisiana, which took him over a year to finish. He courted without success. He took care of some family business. Otherwise, he apparently did nothing at all. He makes no appearance in Jefferson's extensive, often chatty correspondence. William Clark made no mention of him. Was he drinking to excess? Was he depressed? What caused his courtships to fail? He had the journals with him, but he prepared not one line for the printer, made no arrangements for an editor. He had promised Jefferson he would set out for St. Louis in mid-July 1807 to take up his duties and earn his salary, but he didn't actually do so until the late winter of 1808. He didn't even ask for reports from Secretary and Acting Governor Bates on the situation in St. Louis. Any analysis of his lethargy is speculative. Some that have been offered include being unlucky in love or suffering from a manic depressive psychosis, alcoholism, malaria, or some other physical illness. My own guess is that some combination of these explanations, especially the first three, was among the causes, but there were others that exacerbated the depressions and the drinking, and perhaps his inability to find a wife. He had had more success than was good for him. At age 34, he missed the adulation he had become accustomed to receiving. Of course he was honored at home in Charlottesville and Ivy, but that was hardly like being celebrated in Washington and Philadelphia. He had had too independent a command too early in life. Not that he had botched it, obviously he was a genuinely great company commander, but he had become accustomed to instant obedience from a platoon-sized force of the best riflemen, woodsmen, and soldiers in the United States. He no longer held that command. He certainly couldn't get his slaves to respond to his commands as quickly or efficiently as the men of the Corps of Discovery had done, and beyond his slaves, he had no one to order about. In modern popular psychology, he might be said to have been suffering from postpartum depression. Malaria, alcohol, and a predisposition to melancholy would have made it more severe. His unluckiness in love may have compounded everything. We have no clue why he was spurned. He had a lot to offer. He was young, extremely good-looking, highly cultured for Fincastle, with a prestigious and powerful position in the government and outstanding prospects. Perhaps it was a vicious circle. He was turned down because he drank too much and made a spectacle of himself. That might have been what shocked Miss Breckinridge and caused her to flee. A simpler explanation might be nearer the mark. Perhaps Miss Breckinridge and the others could not abide the thought of going to live in a frontier town, albeit the capital of the territory. Lewis wanted a wife to fill a void in his heart. He never got one. Also during this period, he was without a close companion. For 3 years, he and Clark had been intimate friends. In Washington in early 1807, he had lived with Jefferson. In Philadelphia, there was Dickerson. In Virginia, his only close companion seems to have been his younger brother, Reuben. When Lewis finally arrived in St. Louis, he was extremely active on a number of fronts, and we can assume that his courtships were lively affairs, with lots of balls and dinners and visiting, laughter and music. His policy paper was complex and demanding. The work he did on it was outstanding in many respects. Lewis worked on the paper from August 1807 until August 1808, when he sent the finished version from St. Louis to Secretary Dearborn. It contained about 10,500 words. He called it Observations and Reflections on the Present and Future State of Upper Louisiana in Relation to the Government of the Indian Nations Inhabiting that Country, and the Trade and Intercourse with the Same. The plan happily combined two impulses, one to improve the Indians, the other to improve the American fur trade. Or, as Lewis put it, it was a scheme the most expedient that I can devise for the successful consummation of our philanthropic views toward those wretched people of America, and to build an American fur trade empire. He began with a history of the fur trade based in St. Louis during the Spanish period. He condemned the Spanish system of ceding exclusive trading rights to individuals who lived with the various tribes on the Missouri and the other western tributaries of the Mississippi. The traders holding monopoly licenses from the Spanish government badly overcharged the Indians, an evil that was exacerbated by the ruinous custom of extending credit to the tribes. So much for the Spanish system. Meanwhile, the British had gotten into the game. The Spanish controlled the mouth of the Missouri, but the various British companies doing business out of Montreal controlled the upper parts of the river. They undersold the Spanish, thus making the Indians their fast friends and allies. That got Lewis to the heart of the matter. He pointed out that the British traders were now operating in American territory. For the United States, at present, through mere courtesy, permit them to extend their trade to the west side of the Mississippi. Or rather, they are mere tenants at will. This, he thought, mistaken policy. The British had unfair advantages over potential American traders because, through mergers and other devices, the Northwest Company had become a giant with a surplus of capital and a surplus of men, which meant the British had it, in their power, to break any company of merchants of the United States who might enter into a competition with them by underselling the competition. The Northwest Company was already fixing a site for a fortification at the Mandan villages. Following the seizure of the Chesapeake and other British outrages on the high seas and within American waters, war between the United States and Great Britain was everywhere expected. If it came, what was there to prevent an expedition from Canada into the upper Missouri country using Indian allies? And what if it were accompanied by a simultaneous expedition to take New Orleans? What was at stake here was the whole of the Louisiana Purchase, the great Western Empire of the United States. Under the circumstances, Lewis asked, "Can we begin the work of exclusion too soon?" He wanted the authority and resources to mount a campaign to drive the British out of Louisiana. Since he intended to be a part of the fur trade, here was a case where there was a happy coincidence between his self-interest and solid public policy. The government would provide the resources to take effective control of Upper Louisiana, the Indians would be made dependent on the United States, Lewis would be in fact, as well as name, the governor of the territory, and the fur trade would prosper, to the great profit of the St. Louis merchants. Having shown the evils of the Spanish and British systems, Lewis submitted, "For the consideration of our government, the outlines of a plan which has been dictated as well by a sentiment of philanthropy towards the aborigines of America," Jefferson would like that, "as a just regard to the protection of the lives and property of our citizens," and that, "and with the further view also of securing to the people of the United States, exclusively, the advantages which ought of right to accrue to them from the possession of Louisiana." That most of all. Lewis wanted authorization to kick the Northwest Company out of Louisiana. He further wanted to abolish the pernicious custom of giving exclusive licenses to traders and allowing them to extend credit to the tribes. He wanted free trade, in other words, for the Americans, or, as he put it, a fair competition among all our merchants. His plan to realize these objectives was to establish fortifications at various convenient spots along the rivers, especially the Missouri, built and defended by U.S. soldiers, and make these into trading posts where both the Indians and the traders could gather to do business. No more licenses to individuals to monopolize the trade with a single tribe, but a common mart where the marketplace would rule.